The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on September 10, 2022. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Nice to see you all. Welcome, Leonard. Nice to see you. Here we are, second day of Sesshin. Sounds like I'm going to have a little competition from the track event down the street. One time, we were sitting in extended Zazen, which is just, we sit in meditation all morning. That's pretty much it. And at the end of it, now my hearing was really terrible at the time. It's not great now, but before the surgery that I had, it was really bad. So bad that sometimes I couldn't hear things. Like, I remember once being in the Zendo and I was sitting there and there was nobody anywhere near me because of my anxiety. I planted myself as far away from any other human being as possible. And a bell was rung so quietly to my dinning ears because I have tinnitus. I had no idea that a bell had been struck and I was sitting there and I thought I heard like kind of rustling sounds behind me, you know, and at some point I finally went, oh, I think people are getting up, and I turned around and no, people were actually leaving the room at that point. So my hearing wasn't always so great, but at the end of one of these extended zazens, after, you know, from 8 in the morning until noon with just a little break in between, my husband was sitting with me and he said, just as the bell rang to end the day, the Star Spangled Banner played. So we do get some sound from the field at times. It's a nice little accompaniment. So as I said yesterday, I'm going to be giving talks from essays from Steve Hagen's Buddhism Is Not What You Think. And where we ended yesterday, I paired this with a chapter called Pure Mind. And if you may remember where we ended last time, pure mind. Where we ended last time, we talked about the verse from the Dhammapada that sometimes we cite here at Dharma Field. It's actually, I remember Steve pointing it out. It's verse 183, and I was maybe in my second year of studies, maybe my third year of studies, I can't remember. And he said, this verse right here encapsulates what Buddhism is about. This is it. This is the teaching that we're, you know, and I went, it is? It's in the Dhammapada. And after that, I started noticing that it would pop up in some of Steve's talks. It popped up in this chapter that we talked about yesterday. And that is the verse that tells us to avoid what is unwholesome, to cultivate what is wholesome, and to purify the mind. This is the teaching of the awakened. That's the verse. And that's where we kind of ended, and we were talking about what purifying one's mind mean, which is why I thought pure mind would be a good chapter to follow that up with. But I just wanted to go back really quickly to that verse from the Dhammapada, to avoid what is unwholesome, because we're gonna talk about a little bit of we're gonna actually develop or elaborate on some of what's in that teaching. For example, what does it mean to avoid what is unwholesome? That sounds unwholesome, doesn't it? If you're trying to avoid what is unwholesome, it sounds like you're trying to put some distance between you and that unwholesome thing. In fact, you can hear in that a thing that you're trying to avoid, that there's you and there's this unwholesomeness. And really what it asks us to think about is, what does it mean indeed to avoid what is unwholesome? And I can assure you that whenever you think you know the answer to it, you probably got it wrong, you know. Though you probably have an answer that's going to point toward what I'm pointing to. But the difficulty with that is it an answer? Are you hanging on to another answer? I got this figured out. I know where this is going to go. And that would be to still engage in what is unwholesome. And then to cultivate what is wholesome, and I really like that word cultivate, because it kind of helps us to see that what we do now bears fruit in what we do next. So whatever it is we're taking up now, you know, if it's wholesome, we're cultivating that. There'll be wholesomeness in what it is we're stepping into, so to speak. So we cultivate what is wholesome. We just take care of, we nourish what is wholesome right now. And to purify one's mind. And that is actually how we avoid what is unwholesome. How we cultivate what is wholesome is we purify one's mind. And that is to see when our mind is starting to, I shouldn't say starting to, because it almost always is doing this, when it's leaning towards something or leaning away from something, when it has preferences and then when it's acting out of those preferences. When you've bottled it all up, when you understand the situation you're in, when you're acting out of your understanding as if that is the nature of reality itself. So to purify one's mind is to see when you're doing that. And then I talked about this yesterday. It's actually in seeing that what you're doing is you're returning to what's actually taking place, which is you realize that you're conceptualizing and that you're acting out of that or saying out of that or believing out of that. So when we see that we're acting out of a leaning mind, that's actually what's taking place. We can see that right now. That is fully experiencing. That's purifying one's mind. Whereas what we might normally think is to purify one's mind is to let go of something. And like I said, we're going to talk about that a little bit at the end of this chapter. So again, the name of this chapter is Pure Mind. And one thing I just want to say about this purity is that I think sometimes it has a strain to it of like, the first thing that pops into my head is Little Bo Peep. I have no idea why. So, like the fleece of a sheep or something. But I really mean something like somebody who's upright and a do-gooder. You know, that they're pure as opposed to somebody who's not pure. But this pure mind that Steve's talking about is 100% mind. It is pure mind. It's purer than a dove bar is, which I think is 99 something or another. You know, it's 100% pure mind. What is? This is. 100%. This is pure mind. And that 100% pure mind can't be tarnished. It can't be tainted. It can't be stained. Why not? Because then it would be 99.9% mind and 0.1% staining, right? So this is 100% mind. And that mind is pure, not only in it's 100%, but it can't be stained. It is pure. So that's something to keep in mind as we think about what pure mind is. What mind is, that's kind of what this chapter is about. So I'm not going to talk about that right now. Let's just get into the essay here. I'm going to just read the first couple paragraphs. Mind is basic. Mind is primary. Mind is ever present in each situation. For anything to be happening in this moment, mind is necessarily present. Mind is the basis for this, for what's going on now. And then he continues. This is the very heart of what the Buddha taught. All right. And it's not going to be 183. It's a different one. This is the very heart of what the Buddha taught. Everything is founded on mind, is made of mind. To act or speak with a pure mind is happiness. That's where I'm going to stop. Because I want to talk about a few things. First, we get this mind is basic, mind is primary. And I just want to remind you what these two sentences are pointing to is basically the same thing. And that is that mind is fundamental. It is, it's the principal nature of reality, is mind. Reality is mind. Without mind, no reality. Now I know there's something strange about that word. And Steve has talked about this. There was a philosopher who used to attend Dharma Field, who I believe lives in Croatia right now. But he would talk to Steve and just said, why do you use that word mind? That's a really troublesome word. It is a word that has a history in Buddhism. Actually going back to the texts of the Abhidharma, which are texts that sort of expounded upon the sutras, helped us understand the sutras. And they developed this whole way of understanding reality as mind. If you've ever seen any of the charts from the Abhidharma or any of the schools like the Yogacara that developed from the Abhidharma text, you know what I'm talking about. It'd be like 100 dharmas by which our reality is broken up into. And when you look at it, then they break it down into other categories that have to do with phenomenon and have to do with mind. And so this is where this is actually coming from. That's where the term is coming from. But mind also captures the essence of experience. You know, it is, to put it any other way, I don't know how to put it except that we can't conceive of this, of course, because that's conceptual, but it's an experience of mind. Even if we're touching something, we realize that mind is engaging in order for us to be able to experience that. It can't just be hand on wood. There has to be the experience of hand on wood. That's mind. That's kind of the motivating factor there. So on one hand, mind might seem like a strange term, but it really is descriptive just of our basic sense about what it is that's going on. This is what one of the teachings that Steve comes back to, that is a really great teaching about mind from Huang Po. So it gives us a slightly clearer sense of what mind is when the Buddha Dharma, that's the teaching of the awakened, when the teaching of the awakened, when it points to mind. Huang Po's little teaching here is quite helpful. He said, all the Buddhas and all sentient beings are nothing but the one mind beside which nothing exists. This mind, which is without beginning, is unborn and indestructible. It is not green nor yellow and has neither form nor appearance. It does not belong to the categories of things which exist or do not exist, nor can it be thought of in terms of new or old. It is neither long nor short, big nor small, for it transcends all limits, measures, names, traces, and comparisons. It is that which you see before you. Begin to reason about it, and you at once fall into error. It is like the boundless void which cannot be fathomed or measured. The one mind alone is the Buddha, and there is no distinction between the Buddha and sentient beings, but that sentient beings are attached to forms and so seek eternally for Buddhahood. By their very seeking, they lose it, for that is the Buddha to seek for the Buddha, or that is using the Buddha to seek for the Buddha, and using mind to grasp mind. So I'll just kind of back up. There's a lot of stuff going on in that passage, but that's it. That's pretty much what this chapter is going to unfold as well. We have all Buddhas and all sentient beings are nothing but the one mind. And again, that's just mind. When we talk about one mind, we're not talking about one as opposed to something else. It's just one and that. There's nothing outside of it. Besides which nothing exists. So nothing exists without this mind. The mind is without beginning. It's unborn and indestructible. It is not green nor yellow and has neither form nor appearance. It's not new or old. It's not long nor short nor big nor small. It transcends all limits, measures, names, traces, and comparisons. And that's helping us to see that mind, which is always here, always now. And that's what mind is, here and now. Here and now is mind. That it does not look a particular way. You know, it doesn't sound a particular way. It doesn't create a particular experience in us. It's just this experience, whatever this experience is. So it has no way of looking. It has no way that we can grab hold of it. In fact, it is without measure. It's without measure, limits, names, traces, and comparisons. I'm calling it mind. But if you have ever heard Norm give the teaching, I don't know if you have, Leonard, where Norm starts listing all the different names for reality. It goes on. It's a pretty long list. And mind is one of those. Because there really is no way to encapsulate totality. You can't wrap it up. And each of the names that are used to point to reality help us to see reality from some different aspect of our individual experience. So in it, what it is that, how it is we're engaging in this world, these different names for reality, they don't capture reality, but they can point us back to it through often the ways we're getting caught or the ways that we get stuck. So this reality is always here then. In fact, what Wang Po says is it is that which you see before you. So this right here is mind. But it's not that this room and this microphone and me and all of you and, you know, this particular light and everything, that this is it. This is what mind is. No. But it is mind. Do you see what I'm saying? This particular experience does not encapsulate mind, but this experience is mind. And mind is going to be what your next experience is going to be. And it's an experience you had 3 weeks ago, and it's an experience you're going to have in 6 days, whatever. Whatever the present, now I'm going to erase present moment. And the reason why is that present moment does not exist. Present moment is something that you try saying, and this is what we usually mean when we say now, is right now. And then when we say that, it's already gone. So that's the problem with the present moment, is you can't really ever get a hold of it. But now, right now, we know it has to be now. At least I hope we do. I know I've said this before, but when I was a graduate student, I was starting to think about some of these issues. I thought there was no now. I just went, yeah, now is impossible. Because every time I try to get to it, it keeps whittling away. It's always back then or in the future. It's always that way. Well, that's not now. Now is right now. And if you can settle into this now, you can see it doesn't have a beginning or an end. It doesn't have an edge. It's just always this. And you can really sense that. And Huang Po gets at that when he talks about, how does he describe it? This may not be the passage. Somebody's going to describe it as a void, you know, as a boundless void, because it has that quality to it. If you really are settling into now and paying attention, you'll see that it just doesn't, there's nothing to grab hold of. There's no place you can actually say, this is now, other than this is it, right here, right now. So that is, that's very important. So what that helps us to see is everything is mind. And that means when we start talking about this practice and we start talking about what it means to purify the mind, it's helping us to see that we are already mind. We're already pure mind. That's where we are. And Huang Po tells us that. He says the one mind alone is the Buddha. The Buddha is an enlightened being. Now, that's tricky when you say that, because then you think there are people you can point to and say, ah, that person's a Buddha and that person's a Buddha. I've had people do that, and I've been like, people who are Buddhists, so, you know, not people who don't know better, but people who should know better. And they're like going, that guy right there. I remember a friend of mine pulling up a picture, and it was from a war, of course. Maybe not, of course, but it might have been when Russia first invaded Ukraine, when it was getting involved in Crimea, and there was a picture of a Eastern Orthodox priest, and he looked Russian, man. He had a big beard and wild hair, and he had this ornate cross that he was holding, it was some kind of icon that he had, some kind of image, and he was holding it out in the middle of this battlefield. And my friend said, that man is, she said Bodhisattva, but she meant Buddha. I knew what she meant. I just said, you don't know what's going on there. It's a picture in a newspaper. You know, she goes, yeah, but that thing he's done. I said, you don't know what's going on. Stop doing that. You know, so that's not what Wang Po is pointing out. You know, there's these particular people we can point to and say they're Buddha. Buddha is just when one is realizing the true nature of self, that one is one mind. Then one is expressing Buddhahood. One is Buddha. And then Wang Po goes on to say, and there's no distinction between Buddha and, he says sentient things, but then he goes on, at least in this translation, then it's flipped into sentient beings. So we can say there's no distinction between Buddha and sentient beings. Well, what are sentient beings? Those are, you know, sometimes they're called, I want to say sensual beings. It's something like that. But they're just, you know, things that are alive, and to be honest, they're everything. You know, I just say there are things that are alive. They don't have to be alive in the sense that we talk about it. That rock is alive. I mean, if we really understand what life is, everything that's showing up is participating in life. But the sentient beings that we're talking about are people who aren't enlightened. Those beings. So we'll allow a turnip to be a to be a person too. But those beings that are enlightened, that's sentient beings. So what Huang Po is saying is, first of all, there's no distinction between mind and Buddha, and that makes sense. We understand that. Everything is Buddha. Nothing outside of the one mind. And then he says, and there's no distinction between Buddhas, awakened beings, and unawakened beings. No distinction between them either. But, he says, and this is important, that sentient beings, those unawakened ones, are attached to forms and so seek externally for Buddhahood. And now this ties in really closely to, yesterday we were talking about the difficulties or the problem with eradicating evil. And one of the things that Steve points out is that evil is that thing that's out there. That's actually what creates evil, he points out to us. That's what creates good. It's what creates evil. And so when we put Buddhahood out there and we're going to seek it, that's a sign that we're not waking up. We're not realizing our true nature. Because now Buddhahood's out there. Buddhahood's not here. That one mindness, that sense of being mind, is something that we feel we're missing, and it's out there and I've got to get it. And then Huang Po goes on to say, and this to me is the human dilemma. If not dilemma, it's certainly the human tragedy. Because by their very seeking, they lose it. So we sense that perhaps at some point in our life, something is missing. We may encounter Buddhist teachings. I know what it is. It's Buddhahood. Now I'm going to go get me some Buddhahood. And then as you go do it, you're already ignoring the Buddha that you already are. Because as sentient beings, you're the one mind. As a Buddha, you're the one mind. As a sentient being, you can wake up to the fact that you are one mind and then you are Buddha. That's where there is no distinction. What I like, Huang Po says that when sentient beings go searching externally for Buddhahood, he says it's like they're using Buddha to seek for the Buddha. And there's a kind of a funny image that I encountered in Buddhist teachings of a guy who's riding on a horse, looking for the horse that he's riding on. It's that sort of thing. Or like when I, maybe a slightly dumber version, when I had a pencil behind my ear and I was running all around the house asking my husband where the pencil was because I was trying to do the crossword puzzle and he saw where the pencil was, but he wasn't telling. And I went all around the house looking for that thing and I had it with me all the time. That's what Huang Po is trying to point out to us. That's what we do. We are Buddha already. But we overlook it. And we'll talk a little bit about why on earth would we do that? It doesn't make any sense. If we're this, what we in our mind might be thinking is this great, glorious thing, and we at least know that realizing it, we've been told, you're fearless. It's in the Heart Sutra, right? Without anything to attain, the mind is no hindrance, and without any hindrance, no fears exist, right? So we hear that and we go, why would we not just stay there? But there are reasons why we don't stay there. All right, and then Steve goes on. I read that little thing, that teaching of the Buddha. Everything is founded on mind, is made of mind. To speak or act with a pure mind is happiness. And that particular teaching is one of the opening verses of the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada. So it's a chapter called Pairs. Sometimes, I can't remember what else they call it, the twins, but there are verses that come, there's like, usually like a deluded people think this way, enlightened people think this way, and that's, but this is one of those pairs. And in this chapter, Steve's given both of us the pairs, but they're the opening ones. So it's, again, it is, everything is founded on mind, is made of mind, to act or speak with a pure mind is happiness. And to speak with a pure mind, and we talked about this before, the pure mind, this purifying one's mind, same sort of thing. So speak from a pure mind is just to be speaking from a place where you notice when you're grasping conceptualizations, when you're grabbing hold of things or holding on to things, and we'll talk about that, because you can't really do that. And that's our problem. We think we're hanging on to these things, and we realize we've got nothing there. And then, we go searching for it. But pure mind is just to speak from the realization of what is actually taking place, which again is if we're engaging in a mind that is seeing things in a fragmented fashion, that's what we wake up to. We can see we're doing that. And usually we can see we're doing that because something's not right. You know, it could be we're suffering in that moment. Now, when we're suffering, usually we're just going to suffer for a while. It might take us a while to let go of that and go, oh, I see what's going on here. First, we might blame somebody else. It's that guy's fault. I'm this way because they did that thing, you know. And then while you have to sit there with it, you start to realize what's actually taking place. So to speak and act with a pure mind is to speak and act from what's already here. It's what is going on right now. Again, everything is mind. So to speak from a pure mind is to speak from a mind that realizes that it's mind. And so it's to act just from what it is that's taking place right now. So that points us again back to the end of that Huang Po passage, where he tells us that sentient beings are attached to forms and seek externally for Buddhahood. It's right here. And that in searching for it, we lose it. And again, that's that irony of human endeavor. Now Steve goes on, he says, but is it really possible for us to speak or act from such a mind? And just what is pure mind anyway? We've been talking about that a little bit. But he goes on, a pure mind enters freely into each situation, no matter what it is. We may feel sadness, remorse, or grief, but if our mind is pure, it all sweeps through. It doesn't take hold anywhere. It doesn't grind us up. There's nothing in the mind to obstruct the emotion so it doesn't get caught. We feel no need to avoid it. There's that word. Block it. Take hold of it. Work it up into something bigger or make something else out of it. So that's a question that, is this really possible? Is it really possible for us to speak or act from such a mind? A mind that is pure, a mind that is happiness. And people do ask that. They're like, okay, wait a minute. Okay, so mind is everything. And you almost see people like taking, when you say everything, it's a problematic way of talking about it, because people will take all the things that are out there and just kind of go, well, how am I supposed to speak or act from that? And that's why everything's maybe not the right way to put it. All beings is mind. And that is something entirely different from everything. Everything is all the stuff that's out there. And yet, it's not really different, even though I just said it was entirely different, you know, because all that stuff, if we keep looking at it, all of it is just expressions of totality. And that's the thing. You know, you hear something like totality, and it's such an abstract word, and then we might come up with ideas about what that is, and we go, oh, is it possible? Is it possible to have a pure mind, one that's untainted, one that doesn't get upset by things that are showing up, one that doesn't get hooked on sadness or pain or whatever it is? You know, it's a good question. When people ask me, how is it possible? Can we do this? To which I have to admit, I get some frustration back, kind of offered back to me when I say this. But I'm just like, well, that's what you're doing with this practice. How's it possible to live with, out of such a mind? Practice. Now, I cited this yesterday. Clearly, it's one of my favorite passages from Dogen. But he says, if you want to practice suchness without delay. That's it. So when people say, is this possible? Well, yeah, right here. We've got a way. How do you do this? This is how you do this. And then just what is pure mind anyway? Steve asked. And that's the other thing. So it seems impossible to people. And if you're hanging on to ideas, it certainly does seem impossible what we're talking about. And then the other one is just, what is pure mind? It's not that it comes out that way. What is pure mind? What people hear is you don't get swept up by your emotions. You don't get caught up in them. You don't get swept away by them. That's one of the things that people hear. And then they go, oh, I remember somebody saying, I don't think I want to do this because I want to have emotions, you know. And they're like, well, that's not what the teachings are pointing out. It's very easy for people to think that that's what these teachings are pointing to, that Buddhism is talking about a kind of equanimity. I'll probably be coming back to this. I seem to remember in my notes somewhere the word Zen cool. But you know, where the Zen master is unperturbable. And they are, but that doesn't mean that they're not experiencing emotions. The unperturbable is something else that, again, we'll get to as we get further on. But really, I can at least share with you, it means we're not hanging on to the stuff that's showing up. We're not unperturbable that way. But people do hear that. I have friends who just, they laugh when I start talking about driving. Because we were talking about driving. I don't always talk about driving, but we just happened to be talking about things. So I was talking about things that annoyed me about something that was going on in the Twin Cities. We've had some goofy, you know, we're in the state. Where are you from, Leonard?
Maryland.
Where?
Maryland.
Maryland? Yeah, so here we have winter. There are two seasons, winter and then road construction. That's the joke. Yeah, so, you know, we had road construction on one of our major highways for years. It just went on and on and on and on. So I'm sure what I was complaining about was that. Because once the road construction was done, and they said, now, and I knew that this was not going to happen, by the way, but they were like, once years of just disruption to everyone's lives where they're just terrible detours and everything, your lives will be good because then you'll have the 8-lane highway and everyone can. And it didn't fix the problem at all. There's this one weird exchange where 94 crosses 35, two big highways, and they kind of, you know what I'm talking about. It's just like a mess, you know, it really is. And because it's a mess, cars during rush hour get stuck for miles. And once the construction was done and they opened up these new exits and they somehow fixed that exchange, which they did not do, cars were backed up. They seemed farther. It seemed to be a longer line. You know, so I think I was going on about that. And then my friends looked at me and they go, you know what? And I was talking to somebody I hadn't really met before. And so they say to that person I hadn't met before, guess what he is? And they're like, well, I don't know. He's a Zen priest. And I said, you guys, being a Zen priest doesn't mean that I don't get upset about the traffic. Now, what I was doing there in recounting that story, it certainly sounded like I was hanging on to it. I hope that what I was doing was engaging in a comedy routine and that they understood the humor of the situation. So yeah, we you know, sometimes people get this impression that this pure mind is a mind that just isn't moved by anything at all. And then there's this impression that it's almost like a dead mind. But that is not at all what this teaching is pointing to. And in fact, that's where Steve goes next in this chapter. He says, there's a story of a Zen teacher who cried when his wife died. His students were very surprised by this. You're enlightened. Why are you crying? The teacher said matter-of-factly, I'll miss her. What his students were really saying was, we didn't think you were human. It's nonsense, of course. A Zen teacher is a human being with human emotions. Yet many people have this erroneous impression that once we wake up, we won't or shouldn't have deep or powerful emotions anymore. Such an impression is pure delusion. So that's 100% delusion. And you start to realize that you can't have 50% delusion, 50% awakeness. It's 100% or 100%. So in a way, that's unnecessary to have pure in there. But I get why he's doing it. It's pure delusion. Why would awakening cause us to suddenly relinquish all human feeling, to become something other than human? With a pure mind, our feelings are not fundamentally different. But what we do with them, or more appropriately, stop doing with them, is very different indeed. You know, think about what we do, especially when we have powerful emotions. and how we create stories and how we hang on to them and think about how we were slighted. You know, the story I was telling the other day about the message I got from my friend glorying in the death of a former acquaintance of ours. That fellow that we were talking about, he was obese. He was like 400 or 500 pound guy. So really big guy. And when we had kind of finished our exchange and we both kind of worked out where we were coming from, and I just said, I think now we can put this gentleman aside because he's a bit too heavy to keep carrying. You know, and I had my problems with this guy, and I stopped carrying him a long time ago. But it was clear my friend hadn't. I don't think you can say something like he did without carrying that. And that's what we do with our emotions. We hang on to them, especially if we feel that there are things that have been inflicted on us and the emotions and our responses to that. So I wanted to share with you this story about the Zen teacher who cried when his wife died, and the teacher's kind of going, ah, unbelievable, is he crying? I remember when, this might be a little personal, I probably won't share this, but I'll share some other stories, because this is not an uncommon story. I remember when I heard about Trungpa Rinpoche, the great Tibetan American teacher. He was friends with Suzuki, with Shunryu Suzuki, and when Suzuki passed away, Trungpa cried, and his students were surprised by it, and he said the same thing, I'll miss him. You know, he was my friend. And it just seemed to me really strange that his students didn't think he was going to cry. But like I said, here at Dharma Field, I kind of encountered that. People are going, I didn't think that person was going to have emotion. Or I encountered this story when I was just trying to see. It seemed to me I had encountered a couple different stories about Zen masters who have feelings. Not just crying, and I just happened to find these things about crying. And one of them is told by this author of an article in Tricycle magazine. He said, my teacher told a story about a time when he had lived in Korea and studied with a Zen monk. One of the nuns in the community had died, and at her funeral, the monk wept uncontrollably and hysterically in a way that was almost embarrassing. My teacher, relatively new to the practice, was surprised that the man hadn't shown more equanimity and brought the matter up in an interview. The monk burst into laughter. That nun had been a dear friend of his, he said. They had joined the community at the same time, and he was sad she was gone. He expressed his grief when he felt it, and now he could go on. And that's really important, too. So what Zen teachers do is they don't quash those emotions. They just let the emotion burn through. There you are. You're sad. Be sad. This guy was so sad he was weeping in a way that somebody found embarrassing. You know, so it's not to quash these feelings. It's to just let them come. Otherwise, you're hanging on to it. If you're going, I can't do that. People won't think it looks good. Or a Zen priest doesn't do that. You do that, and that, you're going to be hanging on to that. And that's going to be weighing you down. It's going to come back. And then you get to work with it then. And usually when it comes back, it's got another inflection to it that makes it even more challenging to us. And then the other one that I came up with. So the reason I'm coming to these different stories is we have three different things that the teachers who are talking about it come up with. Are you want to ask a question? Or?
No.
Okay, that's okay. That's okay. I thought you were. You can go ahead and do that. it's just that the teachers all come up with different things. So Steve was saying that the students were saying about the teacher, we didn't think he was human. That when you are awake, that somehow you step out of this realm where we experience pain, where we experience hardship. And that's not at all what this practice is. This practice is about living in this world where we're going to experience pain and experience hardship, but to see what's actually taking place so that we don't, you know, go, that sucked, that was evil, for example, to use yesterday's word. In this second one, this teacher said, you know, you feel it, and now you can go on. And this teacher says liberation wasn't a matter of acting a particular way, but feeling how you felt, whatever the situation. And that's the nature of reality. It doesn't show up any particular way. It always shows up like this, but like this shows up in all kinds of different ways. So it's not going to show up a particular way. So when we talk about this practice, sometimes people go, well, how do I do that? And that's such a hard question to answer, because, you know, I say, well, you're doing it. And now I get some frustration. And sometimes if somebody's talking about something very serious to them, they get really frustrated. He's like, stop doing that. I want help here on what this is. Normal say, case by case. That's the same idea. It's just, we just deal with it as we deal with it. And if we deal with it gracelessly, that's how we're dealing with it. Then you deal with whatever the consequence of that is, whatever shows up from our dealing with it gracelessly. And by gracelessly, I just mean in a way that we might find embarrassing, right? Doesn't matter. And then the final one, this is from Alan Watts, The Way of Zen. It's the story of a monk who wept upon hearing of the death of a close relative. When one of the students objected that it was most unseemly to show such personal attachment, he replied, don't be stupid. Don't be stupid. I'm weeping. This one's interesting. He goes, I'm weeping because I want to weep. But really, I think that's that same thing. It just weeping is what's showing up. Why would I not do that? This is all a matter of being what is. That's what our practice is. This is what's showing up. This is what we realize. This is what we see is occurring. So we don't stop emotions. We don't stop thoughts. We don't stop anything. Now you'll hear teachings, they'll say, stop. Steve will sometimes go, stop it, stop it. But when they're saying stop it, it's not the way we normally think of as stop, which is to somehow stop it. When they say stop it, they mean wake up and come back to this right now. That's how you're going to stop it. You're not going to stop it by stopping it. If you stop it by stopping it, whew, you know, that's where we're going to get lost. That's where Huang Po is at the end there. So we just simply come back to here, to now, to thus. The Buddha also said, everything is founded on mind, made of mind. To act or speak with a corrupt mind is misery. What does it mean to act or speak with a corrupt mind? A corrupt mind is a fractured, splintered, broken, divided mind. A mind that sees this as opposed to that. It's the mind of self and other, of separation and alienation. In other words, our ordinary mind. In a corrupt mind, emotions and ideas arise, just as they do in a pure mind. But then we grab hold of them rather than let them pass through and sweep away. We hold them close and build all kinds of mental structures around them. We carry them around with us, identify with them, and put them on display. In other words, a corrupt mind is removed from the whole. It's the mind of ego, a mind that views everything as though apart from itself. It's a mind that gets caught up in greediness, selfishness, fear, longing, loathing, and grasping. The Buddha did not hesitate to call this mind misery. Misery. Lean into that misery in just a moment. So this Buddha also said, everything is founded on mind is made of mind. Does that remind us of that first quote? Everything is founded on mind, made of mind. So this is the paired verse. And this one is, to act or speak with a corrupt mind is misery. And so, well, I just want to talk about that word corrupt, just because it's kind of an unusual word. What is a corrupt mind? And I think it's just kind of laden with possible morality, just like pure is. But what corrupt is, I think, at least as the awakened are pointing to it, this corrupt mind, remember, any mind is the one mind, and the one mind is pure mind. And pure mind is untaintable. It's incorruptible. So when we're talking about corrupt mind, we're actually talking about a mind that this corruption is that it's made unreliable based on errors. Errors of understanding. So that's a definition of corruption is, corrupt is to made unreliable by errors or alterations. And so this corrupt mind is corrupt in that it is actually relying on errors. You know, it's misunderstanding the nature of reality. It's misunderstanding the nature of mind. And so it's corrupt in that way. It's making errors in how it's understanding the world, and it's understanding it conceptually. And in doing that, it is then acting and making more errors, basically. So out of confusion comes confusion. That's the corrupt mind. So to speak or act with a corrupt mind, with a mind that is mistaking what reality is, this is misery. And let me just, before I get into this misery here, I want to talk a little bit more about that corrupt mind. Because that corrupt mind, as I said, is a mind that's overlooking reality. And I had pointed out earlier, why is it that we would overlook reality? And I had somebody ask me this within the last week or so. They said, it doesn't make any sense. And I remember thinking the same thing. If the way the teachings seem to be pointing to, if this is the nature of reality, well, I remember somebody asking, why isn't it obvious? But it is obvious. It's just right here. You know, so the question is, why would we, for this thing that's supposedly obvious, how come we're all so confused about it? And it's because we mistake what's going on, because there's this very, and this is actually going to be what tomorrow's talk is mainly going to be about, the way the world shows up to us and how we wrap it up in ideas, wrap it up in boxes. And then you wrap it up in a box, you put it in a box, and then you wrap that box up. You know how we do that, how we box things, give things edges, we conceptualize, and then we have graspable things. So our misconception of this reality is there's this stuff. And once we have stuff, and I'm gesturing like I'm just talking about that, but I'm also talking about, I'll point up here, because that's where we think it is. Though I don't know where we think emotions come from, but certainly thoughts and emotions. You know, we have these things, and we hang on to them. We think we've got them. And the ones that are most insidious are those ideas we have that we believe in. And so they're really our beliefs. And beliefs, the reason they're insidious is just, they're the things that we believe are real. And that's why we overlook reality, because there are these beliefs, and they come immediately to us from this experience that we're having of a world that's made up of things. It just all comes together. And again, we'll talk about this more tomorrow, but so we have these graspable things, and what we're going to discover is we don't have these graspable. And the things that we think we have hold of, we're going to find out they're not real, they weren't really there, or we don't really have them, or at least we don't have them the way that we think that we have them. And then when we realize that, then, and again, we may not realize it in the way I'm talking about, where we go, that thing I thought I was holding, I no longer have. Really what's going to show up is, probably what's going to show up as, something feels missing. Or you start reaching for something, you start looking for something, and you may not even know why at first, but it's because you think you've got something, and you're starting to realize you don't have something, but you still are operating out of the logic that you can have something, so you're trying to get something to fill the hole of the thing that you know, and it's a cycle. It works like that. It is very funny, but it's also painful. Because that is how we live. And that's where craving comes from. And so, you know, the Four Noble Truths, that second noble truth, Buddha says, a lot of times you'll hear people say grasping, but the one you see most often is craving. But that's just part of the 12-fold chain. So really, what is the origin or what are the conditions from which suffering or dukkha arises? It's, you could say, ignorance. It's that confusion we make. You could say it's grasping. You could say it's a sense that I am here, being. I was born into this world. And that's one, if you ever thought about being born, especially if you were a child, when you didn't really have a lot of ideas about that, and you're going, at least I did. I was like, wait a minute. So there is like a time before I existed? Okay, hold on a second. So where was I then? It doesn't seem to make any sense. And these things, these ideas and emotions that we think we have hold of, these are things that we identify with. And how does Steve put it? I want to make sure I'm not skipping past the section I just read. Okay, I did not. So Steve says about these ideas and emotions, he says, we carry them around with us, We identify with them and put them on display. And that was the part when I read that, put them on display. Right, and we do that. So we have these, and again, we're not frequently not doing this consciously. Sometimes we do. We might have a football team we really like, and it almost feels personal when our football team makes mistakes or and they lose a game or whatever, you know. And so there's a more conscious thing. But a lot of times, just ideas that pop up, and then we find ourselves, we kind of grab hold of them. We don't know we're doing that, and then that's me. That's who I am. And then we display them in all kinds of ways. I think of bumper stickers where people are like espousing their philosophies of the world or identifying themselves. What did I see once said something like, I'm a conservative Catholic voter. That was at the bumper sticker. And I just went, what am I supposed to make with that? You know what I mean? Like, yay for you, you know. But people have bumper stickers that, again, little thoughts or something to identify themselves. Flags. People use, there's all kinds of flags I see now that people use to say, this is what I believe in. You know, I think about myself and the fact that I own thousands of books, you know, and you could, I mean, I don't do this anymore, but I know there was a time when I basically would like, it was like I wanted to pose in front of my books because these books were like an expression of, a very important expression of who I was, you know. And so when those things get challenged, I will say, you know, yesterday I was talking about Pauline Kael and the fact that she wouldn't date a guy that didn't like the same movie she did. That's the kettle calling the pot black or whatever that expression is. Because here I was, I remember when I was dating and some people set me up with a guy. They said, oh, you're going to like this guy. He reads a lot, you know. And so when we got together and he started telling me about what books he liked, I just went, I was like, this date's over. I didn't even connect that until I was putting this talk together. And I was like, yeah, me and Pauline Kael. I remember thinking Pauline Kael was an idiot when she said that. And there I was doing the same thing. Because we identify with that stuff in ways that we really don't get. That's why we hang on to it. That's why we have problems waking up. Because we identify with the beliefs, with the way we've constructed the world. We think that's home. We don't realize this is home, but we've constructed this stuff. We think that's home. This is where, you know, that stuff that we've constructed is where we belong. And that's why we overlook reality, because we've constructed these little things and we're so involved with them that to give them up, it seems impossible. Now, I just want to remind you, Zen would not ask you to give those up. Then you kind of go, well, wait a minute, so then I would be living from a cross. No, Zen is asking you to see you're doing that. Because we don't even realize we're doing that. It's just the first thing. Again, there are some that will be obvious to us. We can see we're doing that. But then there are those subtle ones that I mentioned yesterday. You often don't even know you have until they're challenged in some way. And then the core of your being kind of lights up. Or it bottoms out, or whatever it is, whether you're frightened or angry, but something's going to let you know, oh, there's an identity that you're unaware of, or that you may not quite know that you're hanging on to. That's where the misery comes in. So the misery comes from living a life where we get jostled around because the world is just not matching the way we put it together. And again, we may not think of it in terms of misery. I know I mentioned repeatedly about the friend of mine that when I accidentally used the word misery about how we were, and she just snapped at me, I'm not miserable. And she turned to her husband, Tony, am I miserable? And I was just like, whoa, I guess I, you know, that's the stuff I'm talking about. Actually, you know, if you really want to know, well, we may not see that. And we may actually do something like point to a situation like, well, people in Darfur, people in some horrible situation, that's misery. I got it really cushy, right? And all you're doing when you do that, is I'm not saying those people aren't living in misery, but you're just deflecting from your own situation what it is that's going, because it's easier to do that. Then we don't have to look at the things we think make us comfortable. And we only think they make us comfortable because they might for a while, and they'll make us complacent. And then reality is going to shock us. There's another image from the Dhammapada that's sort of about this, about how when we hang on to our ideas and we don't really look at our lives, really look at what's taking place, that we're like a sleeping village in the monsoon season and river floods out and washes us away. Completely unexpected. We're asleep and it just washes us away. So that's what happens. You know, and that's where the misery is. Because there's your misery right there. But I'm guessing, actually, that even the people who say, I don't have misery, that person was expressing it right there in, you know, her response to what I was saying. And actually, I would say for most of us, misery shows up in small ways. The big ways and the small ways really aren't different. We just make them. We go, oh, that's bad. This isn't. But what happens when we drop the toothpaste cap and it goes down the sink drain, you know? Or what happens when you bang your shin on a table? Or what happened to me when I was just biking recently, then I was on a gravel path, so I should have known better. I was on a gravel path, and it was a really busy weekend. It was Labor Day, and I remember telling myself, just take it easy. My husband likes to pass everybody all the time, and I'm like, you don't have to do that. But sure enough, one of the first people who was passing, I looked and I saw a bike coming our way and I went, maybe we can do that. I don't think that'll be a problem. And then once my husband, so we were passing two bikes and my husband didn't quickly pass them. He just moseyed and I'm behind him, like right behind him. And I'm watching this other bike coming our way and I was going, oh my God, the only way I'm going to get out of this is run off into the grass. Beyond which there were immediately woods. So I just had this real like, well, I don't want to do that because I'm going to crash for sure. So what did I do? I put my brakes on a gravel path, and I went, and I slid behind everybody, and I wiped out, and I actually have some little, you know, tags from my little journey. But, you know, and then what happens? I actually will say, you know, and the fact that I'm proud of it means this is misery too. But I didn't yell at my husband, which would have normally what I've been. I would have blamed him for that. I'd have been like, why did you da-da-da-da? Instead, and he didn't even know I wiped out. He just kept going, you know. So finally I caught up to him and I said, you do know I wiped out back there, right? But yeah, so we experience misery every day and in those little things. That's where we can see it. Is how often we kind of lose our cool about something kind of dumb. And if we're losing our cool at something dumb, why do we think that that's not misery when every little thing can sweep us away and make us angry? Or if not everyone, every fifth one, whatever it is, that finally we just go, I've had it. I can't take any more of this. We know this happens every day. There are things that just kind of knock us off our balance a little bit. Steve says, Zen practice is about recognizing this corrupt mind for what it is. It's about seeing what's going on in each moment without grasping it, without blocking it. It's seeing the folly and misery of the corrupt mind, seeing that trying to take control only creates pain. This seeing is itself an expression of pure mind. We're always dealing with now, with what is actually taking place. Thus, in Zen practice, our focus is on what's going on in our mind now. And since I've been kind of talking about a lot of this stuff already, I just thought I would unpack a few words. And they're words that if you have studied at Dharma Field, to come to talks or whatever, you've heard them before. But he's been using this word seeing, the italicized seeing, throughout this book. And I mentioned it yesterday that he was using it. And in his most recent book, The Grand Delusion, Steve defines these terms. So I thought I would just pull out the grand illusion definitions just to remind us, because seeing can have connotations to it just from the way we generally would use that term, which would either be literally like seeing something or seeing something like, aha, I understand it, which would be an intellectual seeing. And Steve's not talking about that. So the seeing he's talking about is, and here's this definition, pure perception, which is not limited to eyes and brains. So it's not just seeing and knowing, right? Seeing is immediate and without limits or location. This seeing is itself an expression of pure mind. That's it. So it's just this right now, the most immediate thing, that's seeing. And again, we usually overlook what we see. We're usually, in a way, blind to what it is we're seeing. So this seeing is objectless awareness. And when I say seeing is itself an expression of pure mind, I felt it necessary to say this isn't bragging. Because I remember I was telling somebody about this meditation practice. He said, well, this meditation practice is the realization of totality. And the person just kind of looked at me like that. And I said, no, I don't mean to say the way that you seem to think I was saying it, which is that this is the only way to do it. I'm just saying that when we sit in this posture, that's all that's happening is this pure mind, which is always here, is just purely expressing itself. So it's just a description of what's going on. And that now that Steve talks about is kind of the now that I was pointing to earlier. He says now is without time, not to be contrasted with then or confused with the present moment. And I pointed that out before. A lot of people think this is about coming back to the present moment. But the present moment, just that word moment alone, the language is difficult. So a lot of times we will say, moment by moment, because that's the way things seem to be appearing. But when we're talking about now, we're not actually talking about that. We're actually just talking about this. He said it appears only within the context of time. That is, a now that's got a then, or a present moment. That one is caught up in time. Both now and then are concepts. Now, the italicized now, is not. Now alludes to objectless reality. And that objectless reality that this is referring to doesn't mean that if we are, settling into now, that everything vanishes, which of course we know it doesn't. But it's just that we don't, again, it's like what Steve was saying with emotions. We don't hang on to these objects. We don't understand them the same way we usually do, which is discrete things that are separate from one another, that are separate from me. Rather, these objects become objectless in that we no longer understand them that way. So I just wanted to kind of remind you what those terms were about, so that we can see then that Zen practice is about recognizing this corrupt mind for what it is. Right, so we're not trying to do anything with it. In recognizing it for what it is, I'm guessing, I shouldn't say I know, I'm guessing all of you have experienced this at least once, where you're thinking in meditation and you just noticed you were thinking, and when you noticed you were thinking, the thinking stopped by itself without any coaxing. This sort of thing too, that once we can see what it is that is causing this, and it might take some looking, we will just sort of let it go. It takes care of itself. It's about seeing what's going on in each moment, seeing the folly and misery of the corrupt mind. And we do that often through the misery itself. So that's where we start often, is we're not feeling so good about something. And we can start to see what it is that we're hanging on to, or at least that we think we're hanging on to. And this seeing itself, that's just pure mind, this awareness that right here, just the seeing, this direct, immediate experience. And so we're always dealing with now that's that objectless awareness that is timeless. But here it is. And the word here is another one of those. And I'll define that in just a moment. So Steve says, misery of any kind, whether it's fear, anger, loneliness, sadness, or grief, has grasping in it. So when we have misery, we know there's some grasping going on. We can see that. And we're not asking you to believe that. That might sound like here's a formula. Misery, I'm grasping something. You don't have to do that. Just settle into the misery and see what's really taking place. It'll become clear to you. Even at first, it was really clear to you that somebody else is at fault. That gentleman from my past that I thought screwed my life up. I started realizing, well, who did what? What? Oh, interesting. I did what? I see. But it could take a while. It took me years to work through that one. So, misery of any kind has grasping in it. To the extent that we learn to recognize this, we can let it go Let it wash through. This is the practice of meditation. As we sit in meditation, thoughts keep coming up. Sometimes they can be disturbing. Sometimes they're wonderful. But they keep coming. And sometimes we grab onto them. We build upon them, constructing whole mental worlds. This is the corrupt mind Buddha spoke of. Our practice is to see that we do this. Another common error of corrupt mind is thinking we have to let go, as if letting go is as a specific willful act, but it's not. And I love this. Just as falling asleep naturally is not. So you can't go, fall asleep, fall asleep. You know it's not going to work. And in fact, if you've ever had problems sleeping, you know that if you try to make yourself go to sleep, that is like the worst thing you can do, because then you're just going to be tossing and turning, going, how come I'm not going to sleep? How come I'm going to count sheep or whatever the things are you do? And you go, how come I'm still not getting to sleep? Oh, there you go. In our ignorance, we deliberately, forcibly, we try deliberately, forcibly to let go of our thoughts. We try to control a process of letting go. But this will never work. Just as you can't force yourself to go to sleep, and this is beautiful, you can't force yourself to wake up. You only need to see to let go. Indeed, to just see is to let go. Or rather, it's not to take hold of anything in the first place. Mind is already here. So again, this is where we're coming back to here all the time. So we don't have to let go of anything. We never had it, and we can see that here. We don't have to go anywhere for that. Mind is already here. Thus, a pure mind is always possible for us. We only have to be scrupulously honest with ourselves. And that's the hard part, that scrupulous honesty. Because we might be hanging on to things we think are really dear, and we think, well, I don't really want to give that up. That dream of being a famous, whatever. You know, I guess for me it was a stand-up comedian. I don't want to give that up. Hang on to that. I'll put that in my backpack. You know, whatever it is, we've got to be scrupulous about this, scrupulously honest about what it is we're hanging on to. Purity and freedom are immediate. We only need to see, let them sweep through. So just let it happen. Cry when crying needs to happen. Just let it sweep through and don't interfere. So yeah, the practice then is just really to be now. It's to be what it is that's showing up. To not reject or try to do things with what's showing up. And that's usually what we do, is we try to manipulate what's showing up in some way because of our understanding of it. And that's that letting go that Steve's talking about. You'll hear a lot of people that say, like, you have a thought, let it go. You know, you have, you're feeling misery, let it go. There's letting it go, or letting go seems to be a phrase that you encounter in Buddhism. And I guess what Steve's trying to help us to clear up is that letting go, again, doesn't mean, you know, the act of Buddhism is now I let go of things. You know, that's not it at all. You just added an extra step. Because this one really is just about, here we are. This is it. And what is it? That's it. To just keep going, what is it? What is it? What is it? In each step without answering that. And we go, well, it's that. Once you've done that, you've added an extra step. Once you're letting things go, you've added an extra step. Mind is already here. Remember, pure mind. We are pure mind. It's already here. And that here, as Steve defines it, this is the italicized here. He defines it as without location. Not to be contrasted with there, which appears only within the context of space or locality. Both here and there are concepts. Italicized here is not. Italicized here alludes to objectless reality. So, right? So sometimes, often you'll hear here and now. Here and now reality. Because here is the way we spatially get confused. Right? We get confused thinking that we're here, there, and we are. You know, in a relative way of speaking, we're not at home right now. But what does that mean? That's just the concept. That's just a way we have of understanding the situation we're in right now. It doesn't mean anything. My husband's cousin is obsessed right now with tornadoes crashing on his roof. So maybe your house got blown away by a tornado. So you're not here as opposed to being at home. You don't have a home anymore. But you know, it's a conceptual thing. It's Scott Edelstein, who's Steve Hagen's editor, and he's a practitioner here at Dharma Field. He told me this really funny story about how he was lying on a beach one day, and he had his eyes closed, and he heard this really weird boat. And he's like, what in the name of hell is that? So he's trying to picture in his mind, like, what is making that sound, right? And he finally, like, opens his eyes up, and he sees this kid next to him on the beach. You know, so the reality he'd constructed, which granted was ludicrous, he suddenly understood what was going on. That's all we have to do is open our eyes up rather than try to, you know, think things through. So we don't have to let go. Let go is that extra thing. It's thinking we have something that we don't really have. What we have is just this. And we don't have it in the way we normally think of it. It's because it is us. You know, it's just, there's no getting outside of it. So mind is already here. Mind is immediate. We don't have to look for it. And it really doesn't require work. It does require work in the sense that we need to start seeing how we're misunderstanding our experience and how we're grasping that. But it doesn't need work in that really we can learn that we don't need to go through some kind of process. This might feel like a process, but really all this whole formal posture is designed to do, and all of what we're doing here in the Sesshin is really, in a way, you're going to keep bouncing up against your limits and your boundaries. And that's not the whole purpose of this. It's really just to be here. There's no place else to be. When you're at a Sesshin, this is it, baby. You know, and I remember when I did my first one, looking forlornly out the window at, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning going, what am I doing here? But here I was. So you start to get a taste for how we always want to be somewhere else, how this isn't right, and how that is a mistake, because here it is. There's no other way. It can be no other way. I mean, I could walk out, but wherever I'm going to go, it's still going to be here. And that restlessness that I was showing at the Zendo, it's going to look different, but the restlessness is going to be the same. So when we expend a lot of work to try to do this, we just have to see we're doing that and see, because that's our misery then. And we might even think it's fun for a while, you know. Just notice that, you know, this is, pay attention, what is it we're hanging on to? And that is to realize a pure mind. So those are my prepared comments. Do people have any questions or comments? Yeah, and you can come see me in Dokusan if you'd like to talk about some of your questions. I'd be happy to do that. Yep, there's a sign-up sheet on the, Jed might have shown it to you, but it's right around the corner there. Yep. Anything else? All right, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.